How to handle the challenge of the Crusades with Chris Check right now. Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Opponents of the Catholic Church often use the Crusades as evidence for the corruption of Catholicism and for the violence of religion in general. Their point is that Christian claims to be a religion of love and peace are debunked by the reality of the Crusades. And not only that, religion itself is revealed to be violent and tribal. How can a person engaged in apologetics respond to the use of the Crusades as evidence against the faith? To help us answer that question, we welcome the president of Catholic Answers, Chris Check. Hi, Chris.
Cy, thanks for having me on.
So the Crusades... There's like three things, maybe four things that always get thrown up. The Crusades, the Inquisition, and now I'm probably forgetting one.
But Galileo.
Oh, Galileo. Those are the three. Yeah, those are the three big.
And Pius, Pope Pius and the Jews is another one.
Yeah. So
that has been so thoroughly debunked.
However, these things are in many ways, especially not just the facts of the matter, but the impression that they're meant to generate are bunked over the place.
They are
bunked. We need to debunk them because everywhere in modern society, they are bunked.
They are neuralgic topics in church history that enemies of the church use to discredit her.
All right, so let's help the apologist who confronts this. Oh, yeah, what about the Crusades? Because that's basically the entirety of the argument. What about the Crusades? So tell me, what about the Crusades?
Yeah, and I wish that it were like one of those theological questions that we could point to a few passages in Scripture or a chapter in the Catechism or a section in the Catechism, or just the natural light of human reason, as our friend Carlo Broussard likes to say. Unfortunately, events in history are complex. And as you have heard me say, events in history take place at certain times in history. So there is no, I know, right?
History goes in order.
Yeah, right. So there is no way to have intelligent conversation about events in history unless both sides are willing, insofar as possible, to put themselves in that moment and understand themselves as, or understand those events as men of that age did. So it does require a certain amount of background, if you will, to get our imaginations around.
So what's the difference between that, between saying in order to be a fair, even to put myself in the place of a fair judge of history, I have to actually know the history in the sense of knowing what those times are, and having some sympathy for the people of that time and not just imposing my anachronistic values on that. What's the difference between that and just making excuses for people?
Exactly. because so few people who are desirous of discrediting the church really want to take the time to understand the event.
Okay.
And instead, they're just interested in, and it really doesn't take a lot of effort, right? I can flip on something on the History Channel or go back to Edward Gibbon, for example, both of whom have motives, and it's the same one: discredit this institution.
Right.
The
decline and fall of the Roman Empire, by the way, Gibbon's main work.
Sure. And right, right.
Christians did it.
Or more recent, exactly. Or more recent, Sir Stephen Runciman, whose multi-volume set of the Crusades, by the way, is a wonderful work of history and fun to read, and in many ways a good work of scholarship, but so thoroughly informed by hatred of the church.
Yeah.
So let's do this, Cy. Why don't we say what they were?
Okay.
Okay. What were the Crusades? Although really, when we want to get to this question, the proper question is why? Why were the Crusades, or why did the Crusades happen?
Yeah.
But we can start by saying what they were. They were expeditions to the Holy Land, beginning with the Council of Clermont in 1095, ending with the fall of Acre in 1291. Now, historians number these 9 crusades, 8 crusades, 7 crusades. There's some debate there, but that's what they were. They were expeditions, mostly by French knights, some Germans, and then in addition, they had a component of pilgrimage and attached to that pilgrimage, indulgence. Now, of course, that sets off the flags right there.
Oh, that's another thing. Yeah, right. That it has an emotional content that's devoid of any intellectual grasp of what that meant.
It is important. So in fact, that is an example of why, if you can't put yourself in the heart and mind of the medieval Christian, probably best that you don't try to talk about this.
Yeah.
If you really want to get to the bottom of it. I recommend the work of Jonathan Riley Smith.
Okay.
A simple little book called What Were the Crusades? I steal largely from him when I talk about this. Also, Thomas Madden at St. Louis University, another excellent Crusades scholar. Rodney Stark, a non-Catholic, his book God's Battalions. I would recommend those. And all three of these help put the reader in the mind of the medieval man. And I think if we want to try to inform our listeners, that's maybe the direction we want to take this conversation. You're the host.
Like to do that. But let's start at the beginning then.
Okay.
Well,
let me give you an example. I gave a talk on the Crusades one time, and a fellow said, and I actually kind of went through what I hope we're going to go through here today, or what we can take a stab at today, explaining what they were, why they happened, when they happened.
Okay.
And then at the end of it, a fellow who really meant well said, well, couldn't we just say that the Crusades were basically like America in World War II going over to save Western Europe from Nazi aggression? And I said, no, that's really a very poor analogy.
Yeah.
And one reason is because at the heart of the Crusade is this spiritual element of pilgrimage and indulgence. And so, Understanding kind of the religion, the state of religion, the state of Christianity at this time.
Okay, fair enough. Let me just get this from you, however, first.
Okay, am I being incoherent?
No, you're being completely coherent, okay. But I want to say the Crusades happened primarily in what we might call the Holy Land, the Levant.
Okay.
So
I think that word Levant comes into usage after the Crusades, but Holy Land.
Right. So why did the Muslim, why did it happen that the Christian communities that were there in the Levant were peacefully converted by Muslims to Islam, and now all that area was under the control of Islam?
Why so Islam is an Islam is an invented religion in the middle or early part of the 7th century, 630s or thereabouts. Muhammad isn't a fool. He takes some heathen Arabi here, some Jewish mythology here, some bits and pieces of the gospel, and cobbles it all together, and he creates this religion that in the main is spread by the sword. In fact, his parting speech, as recorded by one of the earliest historians, is, you know, go and fight all men until they say there is no God but Allah. And this is what his followers do, because they're promised a paradise of carnal pleasure if they die in the service of the religion. The Holy Land falls to Islam in the early part of the 8th century.
Yeah.
And then a good bits of North Africa. And in fact, it's important to think of this. I know we're going to talk about religion, but just let's just think about the geography. The Mediterranean world, in the mind of the medieval Christian, so even a couple of centuries later, after the conquest of Islam, and we get all the way up into Tours in the 8th century.
Coming up through Spain.
Up through Spain. Right. But in the heart, the memory of a whole and entire Christian world, the whole Mediterranean world being Christian, exists in the imagination of the medieval knight, or the Frankish knight, right? Or the common man of France, right? So that image of a whole Mediterranean Christian world is alive in his imagination. This is the first anachronism that we impose, because we think of the Islamic East and the Christian West. But that is not what was existing in the imagination. So that's helpful,
okay,
right there. Now, to the religion specifically, we have a period now in the 11th century. Of course, Rome in the West has fallen for some centuries now. The church is making her way up into France and has been for some time. Clovis, Charlemagne. And yet, the church doesn't convert whole and entire and suddenly the warrior class of France. So we have a kind of man who rides a large horse and kills for his living, the Frankish knight,
right.
Okay, or the Norman knight. Normans come a little bit later into this story. But this is so, and the church's arrival doesn't suddenly change that.
Yeah.
But there are things that happen in the 11th century, particularly under the reign of Pope Gregory the Seventh, where slowly that energy is being converted into the service of Jesus Christ.
Chivalry?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
It's starting to come into focus.
Yeah.
Right? But these things, you know, they develop organically.
Yeah.
And then devotions, indulgences being one, and let's just set that aside for a second. We'll come to it. But also relics. So the use of relics in devotion, especially under Gregory the Seventh, is starting to come into the practice of the medieval Frenchman. Now, the relic par excellence is the Holy Land.
Yes.
Because this is where Jesus Christ walked and taught and worked miracles and died and rose from the dead. So now you have the idea of the notion forming in the hearts, cultivated by the church, forming the hearts of Christians, cultivated by the church, of graces obtained by contact with relics. And the relic par excellence attained in a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. So now pilgrimages are starting to come into practice.
So as a Christian, say I'm in Italy somewhere. So it wouldn't have been called Italy at the time, but say I'm somewhere.
On the Italian peninsula.
Okay, and I decide to make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Right.
What's that like, say, in the, you know, 10th
in the,
century?
In the middle of the 10th or 11th century. It's a precarious thing. Because there are Christians there with their shrines in the Holy Land, but it is under Islamic rule. And sometimes Islamic rule is tolerant and sometimes it is tyrannical. But nonetheless, pilgrimages at great risk to their their well-being continue to make these pilgrimages. And it may simply not just be Muslim tyranny; it could just simply be bandits, the side of the road preying on pilgrims. So the notion of relics, the notion of pilgrimage, is coming into focus, and the church is using these things to bring into restraint, to bring under control that energetic heart of the medieval knight. Now, so that's kind of the religious situation there. And frankly, if I'm in conversation with someone about the Crusades and he isn't prepared to admit this. And by the way, this is established.
Sure.
Jonathan Riley Smith and other historians since him using source-based history demonstrate this from wills and bequests and correspondence that Crusaders wrote. So we know this. We know this exists. So now what's happening? Okay, let's go to the political history. So that's kind of we've talked about the geography of the Mediterranean world. The religious sense of the people at the time. Now, there's one more key element, and that's the political history. 1071, sorry to have a specific date in there, but we got to know this. Battle of Manzikert. Rome in the east, or what we call Constantinople.
Or Byzantium.
Byzantium, which is a word that they would not like to have heard. They lose big at the Battle of Manzikert. To the forces of what become the Turks, the Seljuk Turks, the forces of Islam, we'll say for the sake of this very broad brush outline, and large portions of Anatolia that were used for agriculture and for the growing of livestock and cattle and horses are now lost to Islam.
Right, they're lost from Christian Europe to Islam.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and see, here's another part of that problem. This is why I keep coming back to the geography, because we think of Christian West, Islamic East. To the person sitting in 2020 right now, Turkey is Islamic, right? But it was not.
No,
it was Roman and it was Christian.
The greatest church in Christendom is there.
Hagia Sophia.
Right.
Yes. So, and this is alive in the imaginations of those Frankish knights. So now you have Alexis the emperor, who his empire now is largely confined to the walls of what is inside the walls of Constantinople, the greatest walls in history, by the way. You can see ruins of them if you go to Constantinople, or what they call Istanbul today. He looks out across those fertile plains of Anatolia and he sees Islam.
Yeah.
Who does he call? Well, at this time in history, who is ascendant politically?
Pope.
The papacy.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you need help, call the Pope.
Yeah. Now, it hasn't always been this way, and it won't always be this way.
Right.
It certainly isn't that way today. But in political history, in ascendancy is the Pope. So I'm sorry to...
No, this is a very... So you get a sense of this. The entire Mediterranean was once Rome.
It was
Rome
once...
becomes Christian. You have this very powerful kind of Christianity of deeply intellectual and beautiful Christianity of North Africa
and
is overrun.
The
Christianity of the Levant is overrun. And then it's we're coming right into what has been the heart of Christendom, Turkey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, this is the heart of Christendom. This is where St. Paul preached. This is where the Hagia Sophia is. And now it's gone.
As you have said, Christianity's origins are in Asia.
Yeah, right.
So, and by the way, Sai, now we are also coming in the middle of the 11th century to the schism. Right.
The
final schism between East and West. I mean, it's so hard to mark this date. There are dozens that precede this. And even this is a marker, 1050 or 1051, whatever the date is, that historians use now kind of as a matter of convenience. But it wasn't as if Alexis and Urban, by the time the conversation gets started, or Hildebrand before him, Gregory the Seventh, by the time that conversation could even have a clear idea, the Pope and the Emperor in the East, they don't even have a clear idea of what the relationship is. Do you mention me? Do your priests mention me at Mass, for example, is one of the questions in their correspondence that comes up. Well, no, they don't. But does that mean we're in schism? And the Pope's answering, well, you know, I'm not actually sure. Right. So, prior to this, East and West had been united. And Sai, if you go to Sicily, as all of the Focus listeners must do before they die, and look at the Monreale, which is a Norman cathedral outside of Palermo on the mountain, north of Palermo, I think it's north, and or south, whichever. But anyway, outside the city. And you see this magnificent Norman, if you will, Gothic cathedral. The interior of it is completely decorated with Greek mosaics by Greeks. And when you go in there, you see East and West perfectly united in this structure. Yeah. So I can't even talk for 3 or 4 hours to properly give what someone who would just go and see this cathedral, or at least look up Monreale and see the union of East and West. And so that's what existed. Right. So now Alexis is calling the Pope, who is in political ascendancy at this time, and he said, I need help.
Yeah.
I need help.
And if you don't help me, you're going to need help pretty soon too.
Right? Okay.
Right.
Very
like
well.
If I fall, you have nothing between you and this massive kind of military culture that's coming for you.
Now, Urban II has a problem on his hands. He understands the political problem, Pope Urban II, that he needs to help Constantinople or Rome in the East, Byzantium, whatever you want to call it. How is he going to get these Frankish knights to go and help? Because there is tension here between East and West, between France and
Latinate and Greek Christianity.
Yeah. So what does he do? Well, it culminates, his strategy culminates in the Council of Clermont in 1095. Look it up if I get the date wrong. I'm sorry. I think it's 1095. And he goes there and he reads accounts of what is going on in the Holy Land. And the accounts describe the treatment of Christians. And one of them says, you know, they take the Christians, they perforate the navel, they spill out the intestines, they tie the intestines to a stake, and then they drive the man around the stake until all of his intestines are spilled out and wound around the stake. And they forcibly circumcise the Christians and put the blood in the holy water fonts, and they're desecrating the altars. And these are reports that he was hearing. I mean, some people say, is this really what was going on? I will say this, they really were the reports that Urban was hearing.
Right.
So some kind of violence against Christians, some of it probably quite brutal, was taking place. Now he goes to Clermont in France, and this is the account that he gets these French knights. Now these men, as I said, these were not namby-pamby men. They're only recently out of the woods themselves. They basically have been killing for a living. So the Pope is making a strategic decision here.
Yeah.
A morally strategic decision. And he's saying, listen, I know the kind of lives that you guys lead, and you are going to have to atone for your lives of violence and brutality. And here's a way that you can put your trade of war fighting in the service of the church. Because they're going to have to go through Constantinople to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he calls the crusade, the First Crusade.
What year is that? The First Crusade?
1094. Well, by the time they get to Jerusalem, what is it, 1091 or something like that?
Okay.
But he calls that that First Crusade. And there are marks of the crusade, right? So the soldiers, the knights, take a vow that is ecclesiastically binding, right? It is called by the Pope. The Pope is the one who calls it, so it's papal approval. It's another one of the signs. There are special privileges and protections that the church says your property will be safe.
Uh-huh.
You are absolved from your debts until you can return to pay them, things of this nature, right? But most important of all, the fourth mark is as an indulgence that attaches to this pilgrimage. So it is an armed pilgrimage. Now, I know we took a long time to get there, and probably even here we're truncating things a bit.
But this is what, but
this is what it was.
The question, this is what a crusade was.
This is what it was. It was an armed pilgrimage. It was
right.
an armed. So that's why that, and that's why that, well, isn't like this Americans going to protect or free Western Europe from Nazi tyranny. Okay, very well.
Yeah.
There's a political element to this, to be sure.
Right.
But it is informed by a spiritual exercise.
And it's not just an outbreak of violence that's rooted in affluence in Europe. Like, now we can do this. It's related to actual historical events that are going on. A real belief that pilgrims are facing persecution and oppression and danger in going to the Holy Land. An actual taking by Islamic armies of what has always been the place where Christianity was first called Christianity.
Yes.
You know, that's what's gone. So this is not some distant recollection. As you said, it's a few hundred years, but these men can remember, because they've been taught, that all of this Mediterranean was a Christian place.
Yes.
At one point. And it didn't fall because, you know, they got the internet. It fell because men with swords came and destroyed that Christendom.
Yes, yes. And the military, to your point about affluence, to be sure, France, Europe, Western Europe is coming into the medieval system that will make a noble class wealthy, but it took an extraordinary amount of money and resources to be able to go on crusade.
Yeah.
So a knight, a Frankish knight or a Norman knight who was going to go would sometimes, you know, effectively have to mortgage vast portions of his wealth. So one of the theories that Sir Stephen Runciman argued this, that but basically these men were going to the Holy Land to get extremely wealthy and live lives in Oriental splendor. No, you went bankrupt going on these things, and there was a chance that you were going to die.
Yeah.
And by the way, once you had fulfilled the obligation of the pilgrimage, what did you want to do? You wanted to go home.
Yeah,
you wanted to go back to France.
Right.
Right. This is why the military religious orders get started, because the church begins to see, Bernard of Clairvaux, of course, is instrumental here in calling for a new knighthood. You need men who aren't married. You need men who by the way, in their lives, make manifest this union of the spiritual life and the political action. And so they become the Templars, the Knights of St. John, who are now the Knights of Malta, and then the Teutonic Knights. There was a German order as well. But they're like they become the standing army, if you will, to continue to protect pilgrims going to the Holy Land and to try to prop up or hold up what became known as the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, though that was always a close run thing and it didn't last.
So are you arguing then that the Christians are really blameless when it comes to you'll hear about certain massacres. There were certain that those things certainly happened. Does the motive, especially the original motive early in the Crusades, does it kind of maybe blanket or cover over what looks to the modern eye like crimes that happened?
Well, in Christian morality, Cy, we judge motives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or God does, but so I shall we say cover? I think that sounds like making excuses. Were there atrocities or excesses of brutality that were perpetrated by Christians during the Crusades? The answer to this question is absolutely yes, there were.
Right, but at least to address that, what about the Crusades challenge?
The one monarch, French monarch, who is a saint.
Louis.
Yeah, was a great crusader. And he died on crusade in Tunis, taking the North African route. And he wrote the most beautiful letter to his son. It is the great letter of fathers to sons.
dig up
St. Louis's letter to his son that he wrote on crusade as he was dying there by the
St. Louis, King of France.
Right.
They should name a mission after him.
I think so. How about one
There's
close
one in
to
my
us?
Town. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Jonathan Riley Smith, what were the Crusades? It'll take you 2 days to get through. You can read it in an evening. It's a slender little book. I think our friends at Ignatius Press publish it. If you want to go a little deeper, Thomas Madden from St. Louis University or Rodney Stark. Read these books. Turn the arguments into your own language. Don't be perplexed or put off by people who come to you with the motive to discredit the church and not to learn something.
All right, and sometime we'll talk then about some of the others, the Inquisitions, Galileo, that
anything,
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. Chris Check is president of Catholic Answers. Thank you very much, Chris.
Si, thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. It really helps us if you go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating or a good review or both. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Let your friends know about Focus. We are trying to grow this podcast, and we can't do it without your help. We'll see
I'm going to go do that right now. Can I give us a 5-star review? Is that permitted? That would be, what would the church, would that be? We'll take that up another focus.
That is a moral conundrum right there.
Can you review your own podcast? What does the catechism say?
We'll see you next time, God willing, on Catholic Answers Focus.